I'd like to just begin by reminding ourselves that a session like this, where we look at Southern Africa, I think we face a certain danger. As North Americans, we tend to feel pretty good about ourselves when we give a little bit of attention to a part of the world so far away as Africa. And I think it's important to remember that we don't give the people in Southern Africa a little bit of attention now as a kind of generous offering to them, but really we do it for ourselves. And I know of no way of making that point stronger than to read again the last couple of verses from the Matins reading this morning, which was very meaningful to me, and as soon as I heard it, I grabbed it and said, that's how we should start our session today. I want to read a couple of verses from chapter 4 of Ephesians. Under Christ's control, all the different parts of the body fit together, and the whole body is held together by every joint with which it is provided. So when each separate part works as it should, the whole body grows and builds itself up through love. So what we're doing today by considering the body of Christ in South Africa, and those people with whom we feel a kinship by virtue of our common lordship, we're doing so not as a generous act of consciousness to give them some of our attention, but rather as a way of oiling the body. I think Paul has the strong notion that the body of Christ ought to be one well-oiled, well-working unit. And the problem that a lot of the problems that we have in the world today, I think, arise more out of ignorance than they do evil intent. And Americans have kind of a bad reputation around the world for being less informed about the rest of the world than the rest of the world is about us. And it was my experience in Southern Africa that Christians there know more about North Americans than North Americans do about them. So in a sense, in a session like this, we're catching up to other people in the world who already know a lot about us. And it's not a generous act of our attention that we give them time in a session like this, but really for our own benefit, that we might be more faithful members of the one body. Let me, since this is the first session over the period of a couple of weeks here, some of you I recognize from my time here at Holden last summer, but most of you are new faces, and so I thought I might start with a little bit of introduction about who I am, where I'm coming from, before we move into the presentation this morning. And as well as introducing myself, I want to say a word about some of the other presentations coming up this week. I spent a year looking for a job everywhere in Africa except South Africa and Rhodesia. Every letter I wrote, the first paragraph said, I want to go to Africa, I want to return to Africa. I had been a foreign student there at an earlier point, and that's where I really got turned on to Africa as a part of the world that still captures my imagination. And I wanted to go back, but I wanted to avoid South Africa and Rhodesia, where at that time white supremacy was the rule of the government. I was interested in black Africa. But as it were, I spent a lot of time looking for those jobs, didn't find the kind of job that I wanted. And long after I had run out my own energy of looking for a job elsewhere in Africa, a job offer in South Africa came along. Now, it was the right kind of job, just in the wrong part of the world. It was to teach in a black seminary inside South Africa, and I had been looking for a job to teach in a seminary in Africa. But I didn't want to go to South Africa. Yet the job offer came to me in 1975, which, if you'll remember, was the time when Vietnamese refugees came into the United States. About 120,000 of them came in April, May, June of 1975, and this job offer came to me in July. Now, I was one who, during the Vietnam War years, had made a real effort to think about that issue, to study the whole debate, the problem that as it surfaced among the North Americans. And I came to feel that I was one who had really made a study of the problem in Vietnam and had improved my consciousness, had become enlightened about the situation there. So it was rather humiliating when, in 1975, I started working full-time with the refugees as they came back from Vietnam. It was rather humiliating to discover how little I had ever learned about the people of Vietnam and their culture. I was working with a group of Vietnamese professionals who were settled in the States before the war ended. People who had come and studied in the United States and had decided to settle here. And so they were members of American society, doctors, lawyers, psychologists, social workers, highly skilled professionals who were well adapted to American society. And they said, when the refugees started arriving and the State Department was trying to resettle all of these refugees who didn't speak English, the State Department, my friends who were well settled in the States but had come from Vietnam said, well, we have a special role to play here because we know the Vietnamese people and the culture, and yet we also know American society, and we can stand between agencies like Lutheran Family and Child Services, which were contracting with the State Department to settle the refugees, and the refugees themselves. And it was my experience that in the grab for funds from the State Department, my friends, the Vietnamese, got left out. And this was partly their own fault, in a sense. They said, we think it's so obvious, the role that we have to play here, that we don't need to be scrambling to write grant proposals and to get money from the State Department to fund us. It's so obvious, the kind of professional role and advice that we have to offer, that if we just make ourselves available in a volunteer way for a little while, then eventually the government will fund us. Well, of course, that never happened. And the lesson of it, I guess, for me was a shock that we approached the war in Vietnam, just as we approached the resettlement of refugees here, without any sense of our own ignorance about the people that we were talking about. The State Department and the social service agencies that were resettling the refugees didn't even realize how badly we needed people who knew the culture of Vietnam. And I think that that fact, more than anything else, that really humiliating lesson of how ill-prepared I was prior to 1975 to debate U.S. relations with Vietnam is what drove me to South Africa, to accept a job in a part of the world that I didn't really want to go to, because I knew enough about the situation in Southern Africa to know that it would be in the minds and in the conversation of Americans before too long. I knew that South Africa is a state which has been building toward revolution for a long, long time, and that American economic interests in South Africa are much more important than they were in Vietnam and Iran combined, and that for that reason, a revolution in Southern Africa was likely to be a big debate for Americans someday. And I came to see this job offer to go there as a call to inform myself about a part of the world that I thought my own people would someday be debating. So I didn't go down to Southern Africa to save them in any sense of that term. I really went to check out the situation for myself so that when my own people started debating that issue, there would be one of us who was not paid by the military and was not paid by a multinational who had experience of that situation. So in December of 1975, before Southern Africa began finding its way into our newspapers, I went down to South Africa to take a job teaching in this black seminary under sponsorship of Lutheran mission funds in this country. I spent a full 2 years and 2 days in the country teaching in that seminary, but also doing a lot of other things. I moved around the country a lot. I'm not going to take the time to talk about all the different jobs I did, because that would take a whole session in and of itself. Suffice it to say that I had a lot of mobility, and I lived and worked in a lot of different circles in South Africa, which is a society of many different groups of people cut off from each other. And at the end of 2 years and that rich education, I came back to this country and have ever since that time been trying to live out a ministry of education about that situation among my own people. Now, I do hope to go back to Southern Africa someday. I'm dying to, as a matter of fact. But at this point, I really think that my role is here. And for that reason, I'm glad for the chance to be at Holden. I was here for a week last summer and met so many people from the Northwest who then went back home and And as I went home, invited me to visit their congregations, and that made this ministry possible over the last year. So I wrote to the people at Holden a few months ago and said I'd like to come back this year because I want to meet some more people. And also because I find this a tremendously creative environment. The kinds of things that I talked about last summer were new presentations for me, and I've been using them ever since. So I'm looking forward to the next 2 weeks to come up with some more new presentations that can be used in the future. So much on me. Let's take another minute to look at some of the other presentations coming up this week. I don't expect all of you will be able to or want to come to all of them, so let me focus on some of the variety of presentations that are coming up, and then you can pick and choose according to the bulletin board. The next one that I'll be doing is Wednesday evening, when the topic is Christian mission, courage to go out in self-interest. And I want to talk about concepts of Christian mission, because I really approached my experience in Southern Africa and my work now in terms of a Christian mission. And I think basically, as human beings, with the problem of sin in our lives, we function on a principle of self-interest. So I want to suggest that there is a self-interest to the way we do mission, or the way we could be doing mission, and that it's more than just draining our pocketbooks. It doesn't have to be that kind of a thing. So Wednesday night I'll try and throw out some new ideas. In particular, I'll be basing my remarks on a book which is available in the bookstore called Missionary Methods, St. Paul's or Ours, written by a British missionary in 1912 who was branded as a heretic in his day and who told his son not to worry about the way he was being ostracized for the ideas that he published in 1912, but to look ahead 50 years. He thought in about 50 years' time, maybe some of his ideas would begin to be accepted. And today his books sell much better than they did 70 years ago. So we'll take a look at that book, which is available in paperback in the bookstore. Thursday evening at 7 o'clock, presentation entitled Women Under Apartheid in South Africa. Apartheid is the system of white supremacy that the government practices in Southern Africa. And we'll look in particular at the effects of apartheid on women, which is a kind of way of introducing you to the situation in South Africa if you don't know much about it. Later Wednesday evening, after Vespers, at 9 o'clock, I'm going to show a United Nations film. Now, this brochure describing the film will be posted on the bulletin board right after this session. Check it out. It's an excellent one-hour color film that introduces how whites came to be in Southern Africa. They have lived in South Africa 30 years less than Europeans have lived here in North America. And just as we think of ourselves as Americans, they think of themselves as Africans. And it's important to know some of that history of how long they've been there and the kind of society that they have helped to build. This film that we'll show Wednesday night is also a study of white nationalism. The only people interviewed in the film are whites. And if you want to get a true sense of how whites feel about their situation and why they feel they need to be the only ones who have the right to vote in a country where they are a minority, then check out the film. It's the best quick way I know of getting introduced to white attitudes in Southern Africa. Friday evening, we'll look at the issue that most Americans tend to want to look at first. There is an organization in this country today called the Lutheran Coalition on Southern Africa. How many people are familiar, know the name, Lutheran Coalition on Southern Africa? Just give me a sense of where you're coming from. Almost none. One, two people. Now, that is an organization formed in the last year which is trying to raise issues about American investments in South Africa, in particular Lutheran investments in South Africa, at every district and synod convention of Lutherans in the country this year. Now, their whole strategy is to focus on U.S. relations with South Africa. And I think that that question is better considered after we study South Africa. And in that sense, I differ a little bit with some of the people in the coalition who are raising issues of Lutheran investments as a prime, as an initial thing for us to study. I want to do a few other presentations on Southern Africa, and once I feel some of you start to have a better understanding of what is happening in South Africa, then we'll look at our own American support for white supremacy in Southern Africa. We'll look not only at the issue of investments in bank loans, but at some other issues such as nuclear proliferation and arms smuggling. Saturday is still an open book. I hope some of you will grab me over lunch today and tomorrow or dinner or wherever and tell me what kinds of things you think we ought to be looking at as far as Southern Africa is concerned. I haven't put a title up for Saturday's presentation yet. And as I get some more feedback from you, that'll be posted later in the week. So, after so much long introduction, let's finally get round to our presentation. As a way of moving into that, I really see, as I've said, my role as not providing information about Southern Africa. I don't think I can do a little bit of that in an hour here and an hour there, but I really can't teach you as much as I think we all need to know about Southern Africa. All I try and do is stimulate a desire on your part to study it, to learn it. And in that sense, I try and get you started studying. And the best way I know to do that is with a very visual, graphic image. Still here, I'm sorry. If I stand up and say to people, I think Americans need to change our worldview, a lot of people get a little angry because they say, you know, a young man talking to people who are older and more mature, better educated than himself, how can he accuse us as not having a good worldview? And the best way I know of changing your attitudes about that, I'm going to turn that around right now, is to show you a picture of how the world really looks, and then to ask you if this is your worldview. Now, that's a strange map to most people the first time they see it. But in fact, is much more accurate than the map you're used to. The map we're used to working with is called the Mercator projection. It's the one pictured several times down here. And for those of you who can see the map at the bottom, that image, or that view of the world, looks familiar. Whereas the one up here does not. And who would have ever thought that Africa should play such a prominent role in the middle of the map? This map up here, every map, every two-dimensional representation of the globe has certain distortions in it. No map is free of distortions. The map that we've been using for the last 400 years, the Mercator projection, which is still the typical map used in high schools and colleges in this country, the Mercator projection was put together for European sailors who needed a map that would accurately show them distance and direction from Europe. So the Mercator projection is centered on the northern hemisphere, Europe in particular, and it grossly distorts the size of continents. Consider, for example, how Africa compares with North America in this map or with the Soviet Union. It looks much smaller than the Soviet Union. It looks about the same size as North America. In 1974, a German cartographer put together a new map. He said, I can't do a perfect map, but I do want to put together a map which is accurate as far as size of continents is concerned. And that's what this map does. Called the North and South Map, it shifts the center of focus from the northern hemisphere to the equator, which is really where it ought to be. And although it changes the shape of continents a little bit, it claims absolute fidelity of area. In other words, it's absolutely true in terms of showing the size of continents. You see that Africa, in fact, is not about the same size as North America. It's much larger, and it is not much smaller than the Soviet Union. If anything, it's larger. So, as a way of just beginning on the right foot with the notion that we do have, as North Americans, something still to learn about our world, let me offer this very graphic illustration that we can go forward if we want to. And I'm glad you're here to engage in some of that. Now this session, Southern Africa, fiction, fact, and faith. The key word is southern, not fiction, fact, or faith. The key word is southern, because I find when we start talking about Southern Africa, it's very important to distinguish between South Africa and Southern Africa. About anything that most of you came into the room having only read about this part of the world in your newspapers would tend to lump the two together. But in fact, as I hope we can show in this session, those are two very different parts of the world and ought not be confused. I want to focus this morning on Southern Africa, the region, so that later in the week we can start talking about South Africa, the country. South Africa, the country, whites have been living for 350 years. It's a modern, industrialized nation that is more technologically advanced in certain areas than the United States. Southern Africa, the region, begins to look more like your typical stereotype of an African country. You know, bush and mostly agricultural, not very much industrialized, that sort of thing. So let's talk about the region, and then later in the week we'll get into the country of South Africa. And this is a map. This is the first time I've tried using the map. I hope you can all see it. If you have trouble seeing the boundaries on this map, then say so, and we'll use the blackboard instead. South Africa, the country, is down here. We'll leave that for later in the week. That is where I live and where the real crunch is going to come in terms of American interests in the next couple of years. But this highly industrialized nation of South Africa, where whites are firmly in control, whites are the only ones who can vote, the only ones who can own land. All the best jobs in the country are reserved by law for whites. This country has always had a buffer zone separating itself from black Africa. By black Africa, I mean those African nations which during the 1960s began to get independence from their European colonial powers. There has always been a buffer zone through here where whites have been able to maintain control, even when blacks came to political power in some other African countries. Whites have still maintained control of several countries in the region here. And in the last couple of years, as we'll see today, change has begun to take place in some of these border states, which is putting more and more pressure on South Africa. And I maintain that after what blacks come to power in these border states, then the real crunch is going to come in South Africa. So don't confuse South Africa with Southern Africa. There is great change taking place in Southern Africa today. South Africa still has to see the day of great changes. I think I will use the blackboard as well here. The first big changes in South Africa began taking place in Southern Africa. I'm sorry. Correct me if I get those terms mixed up. The first big changes began taking place in about 1975. Here's South Africa, a country called Namibia that we'll get to in a minute. How many people know that most of the population of this country is Lutheran? 10%. Oh, let me say one other thing. Those of you who were in on my sessions last summer know that I get real excited about Africa, and in such a short time I just try and pour out, dump as much information on you as I can. But that doesn't mean that I don't look toward discussion. In fact, discussion is the only time I get a chance to take my breath, really. So I'm going to get going here and be putting out more and more information, but I would really appreciate it if at some point when a question arises in your mind, you'll stop me, interrupt me. You'll have to interrupt me if you want to get your question in. But those will be much appreciated. I have never yet had an audience which asked too many questions, so don't be afraid of that. If you do start asking too many questions, then I'll ask you to let me finish, but I doubt that will happen. So please, as we go along, if something I say isn't clear or if I'm not addressing myself to a subject you want to hear about, then shout at me or raise your hand or something. Interrupt me and get your question in. The first crumbling of the buffer zone began taking place in 1975 in two countries called Angola and Mozambique. And that was the first time that Americans began to read about the situation in Southern Africa. The Vietnam War really ended, contrary to Kissinger's declarations. The Vietnam War really ended In spring of 1975, the refugees all came into the States that summer. And that fall, a civil war broke out in Angola, up here. Now, the reason for that was that Angola and Mozambique had been Portuguese colonies until 1975. And Portuguese had had these colonies and a couple of others in Africa for hundreds and for centuries and centuries, something like four centuries. And during that time, they had continued to run the affairs of black people in that country, with the result that a lot of the black people really felt they weren't getting a fair deal. Now, some of the fiction about Portuguese colonial rule was that as Europeans, the Portuguese were superior culturally to the Africans. And so the Portuguese were doing the Africans a favor by being in Africa because they were helping to develop the Africans. I don't have statistics on Angola or Mozambique, but in one of the other Portuguese colonies in West Africa, Guinea-Bissau, after 450 years of European development in that country, there were a grand total of 14 university graduates in 450 years. And over 95% of the population was illiterate after 450 years of development. So you can, I hope, begin to understand that some of the African people in those situations were concerned that they were not being developed at all, that in fact their natural resources were being raped, plundered, and that they were making the Portuguese rich while remaining in the greater and greater poverty as far as themselves were concerned. So they began to revolt against the Portuguese. They led wars of independence in both Mozambique and Angola and Guinea-Bissau. And these wars began to hurt the Portuguese economy a great deal, with the result that a military coup took place in Portugal in 1974, and the new military leaders that came to power said, away with the colonies. Colonies are draining us economically as a country. They're no longer profitable. They're costing more to keep our armies fed down there than we're making in the way of profits. So let's just get out. And in 1975, the Portuguese left Mozambique and Angola, and black governments came to power in those two countries. In Mozambique, it was a fairly smooth transfer to power because there had been one unified group of blacks fighting for independence there. And so it was an easy transition. The group which had been fighting for independence took over and began running the government. In Angola, the situation was a little bit more complicated because there had not emerged one unified group of Africans fighting for independence. In fact, there were three different groups. And the major one was quickly backed by the Soviets and the Cubans. So the CIA decided that they didn't really care who won. They just didn't want the Soviet-backed group to win. And they embarked on a policy of backing the other two groups. Instead of picking out one strong group and really backing it, we just backed two groups so that we hoped the Soviet-backed group would lose. Well, this was 1975, and Kissinger did not get cooperation from the Congress because Vietnam was still a pretty fresh wound in the conscience of the American people, and Congress refused to give Kissinger the increased money and troops that he wanted to get involved in the war in Angola. And the result was that the MPLA, the Soviet and Cuban backed group, came to power. And the group which the South Africans had backed is that the fault. Today, a lot of people in the world are claiming that Mozambique and Angola are getting nowhere, that they are lousy governments ever since 1975, and that the economy is in shambles, and that things are worse off than ever. And what a lot of people claim as being the responsible for this chaos is they feel the Marxist tendencies of these two governments. In other words, they blame all of the problems since independence on the communism of the leaders. Now, whether or not the leaders are really communist, I think we'd have to go into a whole session as to what we mean by communism. Certainly, both the leaders of Mozambique and Angola at times are willing to call themselves Marxists.
Now, it's not necessarily a Soviet Marxism. There's a lot of tension between the Soviet Union and the leaders of these governments. But they do claim to be Marxists. Yet, a lot of other people say that the real problem in a country like this, and the reason why the economy is facing great problems in Mozambique, for example, today, is the fact that as soon as blacks came to power, 90% of all the whites left the country. And whites had been in charge of everything up to that point. So you suddenly lost your whole leadership class, as it were. And this, in fact, I think, is a lot more responsible for some of the problems. Now, your question is really, how can they go forward? And I've kind of explained why they're having some of the problems, both some fact and some fiction, as far as that's concerned. My faith, as far as they're going forward, is based on a belief that the African people are increasingly today beginning to view themselves not as individuals so much as nations or society. More and more they're beginning to look toward their group, or their national group, and to say, how can we rebuild ourselves? And I think wherever you get a nation which really gets behind a common ideal in a big way, that great things can happen. There is a certain strength in numbers which is greater than the sum of its parts. And the people in these countries today, the biggest thing they have going for themselves, I think, is the fact that they feel, after 400 years of being ruled by an outside power, that now they have the chance to put together their own country. And I think on the basis of that kind of a strength, they will go forward, although it will be slow. But they feel the kind of progress that they make will in the long run be genuine progress, as opposed to being crumbs that fall out.
They have been doing that.
Unfortunately, there are certain governments in the world which will not offer any aid unless they can control how the economy will be set up. And the American government, for example, has refused to send a cent to Mozambique because Mozambique says we are not committed to an exclusively capitalist system the way your government is. And our government says, unless you're going to set up an economy the way we think it should be set up, we're not going to offer you any aid. So this has been a problem. But just within the last few months, the president of Mozambique has held some new news conferences, he's invited some new trade missions to Mozambique, and he's gained a lot of publicity by saying, we are asking whites to come back and to help us build the country, to rebuild the country. Now, whether or not whites will come is another story. Incidentally, in the Western press, this has been reported as a failure of Marxism. And when the president announced that he was asking some foreign investment and some foreign white technicians to come in, the press has reported that he's now given up on Marxism and he's going to turn back to the Western way. I doubt it. I think he's going to... I'm really not in a good position to answer the question as well as I'd like to. Now, if you were asking that question about South Africa, I could answer it, because I know a lot more about the background and the history of South Africa. I don't know much about the history. I didn't start studying Angola until the last few years, or Mozambique, for that matter. I think that a lot of the problem, generally speaking about Africa, having disqualified myself from a good answer, I'll give you a bad one. In African countries, generally, one problem has been the problem of ethnicity, also called tribalism in our press. I prefer ethnicity as a label for it. When Europeans came in, they drew boundaries that didn't make any sense in terms of the languages. It would be like going to Europe, and if Africans were to suddenly colonize Europe, they might draw a boundary line right through France and Germany. So you got half the French and German people in one country and the other half in another country. And that has been a real problem over the last 400 years in Africa, where European colonialists have been. They have been able to divide African people from each other and to rule them in that way. And it's only much more recently, during the last, I'd say, three or four decades outside of South Africa and the last eight decades inside of South Africa, that Africans have begun to really make progress on developing a spirit of nationalism which overcomes ethnicity. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good point. In Namibia or in South Africa, you study the history of those countries and you find out that for an awful long time, for an extraordinarily long time, the African people were patient in attempting to change things within the system. They have a tremendous hesitancy to take up guns, to fight for their independence. And as long as they were trying to change things within the system, they were getting nowhere. I'm not going to do the whole talk now because it's on tape from one of my talks last year, but I think it's the talk called Steve Biko or something. It's in the tape library. Outlines in South Africa 80 years of efforts to change the system legally and peacefully. And it's only after they've attempted to do that over a long period of time that they've given up. I scheduled a visit to Seattle recently, a couple weeks ago, a black South African, who made the point that he felt the biggest weakness of the African people was that they've been too patient, in answer to your question, and that they've had too much trust that whites would eventually offer them more rights. And so they hesitated to take up guns. Whereas history shows the only time a colony really gains its independence is by guns. I mean, that's the only time it's happened in history. It'd be nice if it would happen a better way, but historically, that's about the only way it's ever happened. And the African people have been slow to accept that.
You said 90% of the white left. Now, was that on force, or was that free will? Or
that was free will. They fled the country out of fear that there was going to be a backlash. And I think a lot of this reflects some guilt. Whites having kept blacks down, and very savagely, for a long time, have been afraid that when blacks come to power, they might do the same thing.
Yeah, beheaded or...
Right. And part of this is because whites as a minority have always been afraid that,
that there would be a control of power change to the blacks.
And this is a lot of what's going to be raised as an issue in South Africa in the next few years, too, or Namibia today. Let's look at Namibia. I said how this buffer zone separating South Africa, which is the industrial giant and the mineral giant, a crucial part of the Western world, much more important to us than Iran or Vietnam or anything like that in terms of mineral wealth and industrial profits and all kinds of things. South Africa has been separated by a buffer zone, which started crumbling in Mozambique and Angola in 1975 when black governments came to power there. More recently, Rhodesia has been affected. I shouldn't have these two maps up side by side. You'll know that I'm not a cartographer. Well, before we get to Namibia, let's look at Rhodesia, because historically Rhodesia is in a different place. Rhodesia, now called Zimbabwe, as of 2 months ago, was a British colony. Cecil Rhodes, let me give you a little bit of history here. Comes out of an article found in this magazine, which if anybody's interested, why don't you come up and sign a sheet here after the presentation, and for 30 cents or 50 cents, we'll make copies of this available. We'll Xerox in the office and make copies available. But just to give you an idea of what kind of stuff is in that article, I want to cite some of the history of how Rhodesia came to be and the situation developed there. Those of you who've been reading the newspaper, how many people have seen Zimbabwe in the news in the last couple of months? Yeah, most all of you. That's the way our media system works. When a situation is in a process of revolution and it's too late to change it, then it becomes a big issue. And Zimbabwe recently made that transition after a long war. Whites first started going into to Rhodesia in the late 1880s. In 1888, a chief of the people living in what is now called Zimbabwe, a chief named Lobengula, said to one of the British scouts who came into that area, "I will give you permission to dig for minerals in a certain part of the country here." Now, this was because whites started out in Cape Town, the very south part of Africa down here, in 1650. By 1875, they had gotten up here to Johannesburg, where they discovered the largest deposits of gold in the world. Today, 4/5 of all of our gold in the Western world comes from South Africa. And as oil goes up and we realize that we are vulnerable because of foreign control of oil, Westerners are putting more and more faith in gold. Think of how much you've read about gold in the last 9 months. 4/5 of our gold comes from South Africa. In 1875, Westerners discovered that gold was massive deposits of gold up here in Johannesburg. And a man named Cecil Rhodes, who had gotten rich on diamonds in Kimberley and was getting rich on gold in Johannesburg, decided to keep pushing north because he believed, he had an intuition, that there were even bigger mineral deposits to be found up in this country, here, Rhodesia. So he sent one of his scouts up there who negotiated the claim with the chief, and the chief said, okay, if you want to come in and dig for the minerals in the ground, you're welcome to do that. I think it's crazy, but if you want to come in, you can do that. The scout went back to Cecil Rhodes, said, I got this piece of paper which gives us limited mineral prospecting rights. Cecil Rhodes went to England and said, I have control of the territory there. And the British government gave him a charter which gave him all government rights in the entire area of Rhodesia. Now, communications were not as good in those days as they are today, at least not as instantaneous. And this allowed Cecil Rhodes to get away with pulling the wool, really, over the British government's eyes. And so the British government gave Rhodes total control through the British South Africa Company, as it was called, of that area. And in 1889, people started moving in. 1888, they got the limited mineral rights. 1889, the chartered British South Africa Company got governing rights from Britain. I don't know why Britain thought it had the right to give away governing rights in that part of the world. In 1890, Rhodes sent in troops. Once the British government had given Rhodes the right to rule that area, then Rhodes could get the British government to pay for a small army, which would go in and just set up control of the area. And farming rights were offered to white settlers. Plus or minus 3,000 acres were given to any white who would come into that area and settle, because Rhodes knew that ultimately he couldn't depend on his army. He had to have a local white population that would come in and take over. 1893, there was a war between one of the African chiefs and Rhodes' company. Rhodes had guns, the Africans didn't. The guns had long proven to be a superior weapon in war, which has brought a lot of power to Westerners. And they were used in Rhodesia to take control of that area. After the war, soldiers who fought in the war were offered 6,000 acres of land if they wanted to settle in this area. Now, just keep these figures in mind. 3,000 acres of land, 6,000 acres of land. Any of you farmers here? Anybody a farmer here? Is it easy without modern technology to farm 6,000, 3,000 acres? No, it's not, obviously. And the only way it can happen is if you've got people to help you. So the idea was, bring in whites, give them huge tracts of land, and figure that they would then get black laborers to work the land for them. But long about 1894, all this is within a very short period of time now. Whites just came in 1894. In 1894, the whites realized that they weren't getting any help. That Africans were not exactly flocking to these white farms to work for the white farmers. And the reason was that the Africans had a self-subsistent economy and they didn't particularly need money from the whites. They hadn't been operating with money. They had an agricultural subsistence economy and they were perfectly content living the way they were. They weren't about to go looking for jobs to earn a form of exchange that they had never used before. So what the British did was in 1894 they imposed a tax on the Africans, because they said, after all, now we're giving you this government, and the government is costing a lot of money, and we think you should help pay for it. So all Africans will now have to pay a hub tax in cash. This was the first time Africans had ever needed cash. Up to that point, they had been just trading agricultural goods and that sort of thing.